If it's a sports story you're talking about, you can guarantee they'll be talking about it. Unless it's something like Arena Football. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
One thing I said that I would never do. A look from you and I would fall from you.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. It is Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Rory Boylan this weekend. Lots to get to on today's program, including the Blue Jays qualifying righty Marco Estrada. He's going to make at least $15.8 million next season. Lots to talk about in the NHL, including life without Connor McDavid for the Edmonton Oilers, but Jordan Eberle's back, so that's kind of good. And the NFL, things continuing to look ugly for the Dallas Cowboys, both on the field, in the standings, and as far as public relations are concerned as well. So all that coming your way in the next couple of hours. But, gents, we start with the Toronto Raptors, who are doing a good job of keeping Toronto sports fans' spirits up. Following that incredible Blue Jays season, we knew there would be a little void in our hearts, holes in our hearts, especially with not much expected from the Maple Leafs, and the Leafs holding up their end of the bargain in that regard. But Raptors start the season 5-0, lose their first game of the season, game 3 of 4 on this four-game road trip in Orlando against the Magic, ending an 11-game winning streak against that Magic franchise. 5-point loss, 92-87, 5-1, as I mentioned. They were 5-1 again last season, and we know how that year will be remembered. It will be remembered by the lack of success in the postseason, by which I mean a four-game sweep at the hands of the Washington Wizards. So what do we make of this, Jordan? I guess you got to be pleased. Is it a different feeling? Is it a different 5-1 than a 5-1 in 2014-2015?
I don't know. I just say welcome to another wonderful November in Toronto sports, where either the hockey team or the basketball team gets off to a hot start and baseball's over and it's getting dark early and we need something to warm our hearts, so we want to believe. And isn't it nice that we have the Raptors after the Blue Jays? But I don't think anybody can look at this team, and it's nice that they're playing better defense. Of course, they've played better defense before and still gone nowhere in the playoffs. They're going to be a playoff team. They're probably going to be one of the top four playoff teams in the East. And beyond that, I don't know what they can prove to me that they won't have to still prove to me in April.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this team should make the playoffs, should finish pretty high in the Eastern Conference in the regular season, and they'll be measured by what they do in the playoffs. They have some new players on the bench this year in the starting lineup. They have some questions, I guess, on their bench scoring and if that can sustain them through the year. But like we were talking before, off air, what's going to happen with this team the first time they have to face adversity, the first injury they get, the first losing streak they hit, how do they respond to that? Until something like that happens, we're not going to really get a good gauge on what's different about this year's team.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to be a cynical jerk here by saying, you know, wait till April. By
you don't all have means, to try to do that.
I know, it comes naturally. It's so, especially on a Saturday morning.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not a thing with cynicism. It's just a thing of, I've seen it before, and it's nice to see a different cast of characters. Certainly, I think one of the most heartwarming stories so far is Corey Joseph coming home and just lighting it up off the bench. I mean, they haven't been really getting any other scoring on the bench, which, like Rory said, is a problem. But at the same time, there's something in that that fans can root for. I think Jamari Carroll's been exactly what he was sold as in terms of an aggressive defender, a guy who can also score, who can really kind of be a glue guy amongst the starting unit. And that's great. And I like what I've seen from Jonas Valanciunas in terms of him taking another step. But my question for you guys, and it's a question that I ask of any team that we kind of want to look at and say, can this be a championship team? Can this team really compete down the stretch? Is who is their go-to guy? I think in just about any sport, whether you have a game-breaking wide receiver in football, or you know, you send over a Jonathan Toews or a Sidney Crosby or an Alex Ovechkin when you're down by a goal. And especially in basketball, when they're down one with, you know, 20 seconds to play, who's taking that shot? In the playoffs, it was Lowry last year, and for the Raptors, it was JV last night, and it looked ugly.
Yeah, it was JV on a broken play. And after the game, Kyle Lowry did mention that he was certainly open enough to take that shot before giving the ball up to Jonas Valanciunas, and he took like an off-balance left-handed floater in the lane. Yeah, 2 years ago it was DeMar DeRozan. Things didn't go as well in a couple of games. He lost the handle, dribbled it off his foot, and then the Raptors tried the Kyle Lowry thing. And Kyle Lowry was given the ball in the dying seconds of Game 7 against the Brooklyn Nets and was swatted at the rim. I guess that is an issue when you get down to the nitty-gritty, when you're in a close game in the dying minutes.
You can't do that by committee.
Well, there aren't. I mean, yeah, I know it's easy to say, oh, well, everybody wants to have a LeBron James. Everybody wants to have this alpha dog, the one guy who's taken that last second shot. And sure, there are examples of that. And yes, the Golden State Warriors have Steph Curry, but they got a bunch of guys who can take that shot. So, I mean, it is.
But it is Steph Curry who takes that shot.
Most of the time. But if you're being double teamed, like there's certainly scenarios in which he's not getting the best shot or getting the final shot. And it's whoever's got the best shot is taking that final shot. But I mean, I feel like that's almost besides the point, because I look at what the Raptors have done here through six games. They're 5-1, mentioned second straight year that they're 5-1. And it was exciting and it's still exciting. And there's definitely intrigue in this regular season, but what can they do during the regular season to prove to you that they're an elite team in the Eastern Conference, Rory? Is there anything? Like, even if they win the Eastern Conference, aren't we just going to say, hey, okay, that's all nice. The Cavaliers are still the best team in the East because they just don't care as much about the regular season.
Yeah, there's nothing that they can do in the regular season, I don't think, that would change my mind on them. Cleveland is clearly the best team in the East. You could even make a case that Atlanta and Washington, Chicago are better teams than Toronto. It's all about what they do in the playoffs. And I mean, getting back to Jordan's point there, I mean, maybe that's something that they have to figure out during this season. They know that they're going to get to the playoffs. They're going to find themselves in close games down at the wire. And that's where you got to, you know, give the ball to DeRozan a couple of times, give the ball to Lowry, Valanciunas a couple of times. And by the time you get to the playoffs, where you should be anyway, you'll have an idea. You should have some confidence by then, I would hope, of who you're going to give that ball to in that situation. And I mean, if you still don't know the answer to this question after 82 games, that's a big problem heading into the playoffs, and really nothing would have changed with this team.
Maybe it can be Terrence Ross.
Oh,
and
my.
He can earn his $11 million.
He's been brutal since signing that contract.
He can be a ringer off the bench just to take the hardcore last second shots.
He was 0-3 yesterday, only played 15 minutes, and yes, he is making more money, well, set to make more money than DeMar DeRozan is making this year. He'll make $11 million
next year. DeMar DeRozan will make a lot of money next year.
DeMar DeRozan's going to make $30 million next year somewhere.
Amazing.
Maybe not with the Raptors. And maybe
hopefully not with the Raptors.
Well, that's maybe a good transition because he does hold a player option on his contract. He can opt out at the end of this season, which he will obviously do. Something would he'd have to lose an appendage. He'd have to lose a leg or an arm here before the end of the season for him not to opt out of that player contract and get paid next season. Now, is he that guy? He's going to command huge, huge dollars, max type money. He's been an all-star for this Raptors team. He can do some things. He can definitely get to the line. Was the Raptors' leading scorer yesterday? He was 7 of 15. He got to the free throw line 12 times, made 9 of those. Had 7 rebounds as well. And you know what? The assist numbers have been nice this year as well. But can you hang your hat on DeMar DeRozan being your best player if you expect to be one of the best teams in the NBA?
Well, it's funny because he's going to be a max player probably. And this is the reality of the NBA. The salary cap's going to go up by $20 million. And some players who you look at now and say, oh, they're pretty good, but they're not elite, are going to get paid as though they're elite. And DeMar DeRozan's going to be one of them. And you know, he can do a lot of things, but we were just talking about who that guy is at the end of games for the Raptors. And if DeMar's going to go off and be a free agent and get max money after playing for a team that didn't have that last second go-to guy, and he couldn't be that, and he's still going to get max money, it's just a a nutty way to go into the NBA offseason.
Again, maybe he shows it this year, and by the end of the season, we're not too worried about it. But, I mean, if you don't keep him, I'd be worried about how you replace that. It's not going to be easy. I mean, he does have his problems in his game, but when it comes down to it, he is their scorer. And if you suddenly lose that from your lineup, where is that replacement going to come from? How are you going to fill that hole? Because it's going to be a huge hole, and suddenly, where are the Raptors then?
Yeah, and I don't mean to slag DeMar DeRozan, because he's one of the absolute...
Said the guy who just slagged DeMar DeRozan for 12 minutes.
But he gets to the line better than basically anybody in the NBA right now, and that is a valuable skill, and he deserves to get paid for that skill. I'm just not necessarily sure about the rest of his game.
We've been nitpicking this 5-1 start for the Raptors for the last couple of minutes. Should we not just be watching this season and enjoying it? And I know it's... Part of sports radio is to, I mean, create talking points. That's all well and good. But shouldn't it just be, hey, this team isn't winning an NBA title this year. Let's just enjoy whatever fruits are born out of the regular season. And when it comes to the postseason, that'll be nice and good too. But really, the expectations aren't that high. You beat the Oklahoma City Thunder. I know it's just a regular season game, but should there be more joy involved in a big win like that, Rory?
Oh, heck yeah. That was an awesome win. I mean, the fact that it was on the second half of back-to-back games in Oklahoma City, that is one of the best teams in all of basketball. And the Raptors not only beat them, they came from behind to beat them in the last minutes there. I mean, that was an impressive win. And yeah, you know, they lost to Orlando, and that's a tough way to follow that up a couple nights later. But like Dwayne Casey said last night, they weren't going to win all 82 games anyway. But how long has it been in Toronto since we've had good teams? And now we've got the Blue Jays that just had an awesome season. The Leafs are not going to have a good season, so there's nothing to root for there all winter.
But the Leafs are having a good season off the ice. Like, it's a good year. Yeah, they're having a good year off the ice. It's a good year for the Leafs.
Yeah, but, you know, all winter, when it gets cold and snow starts falling, the Raptors are going to they're going to be the team. Enjoy it while it's here. It's not often that we get these good teams to cheer for, and they're still one of the better teams in the Eastern Conference. Yeah, they probably don't match up well to Cleveland, but they could make the Eastern Final if everything goes well for them, and what is wrong with that? That would be a great season.
It certainly would, and this team will be judged on its postseason resume. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Annis alongside Rory Boylan and Jordan Heath Rawlings. So I know last year, despite the strong start, there were people watching that season with a skeptical eye, right? Oh, well, they're beating up on the terrible Eastern Conference, the terrible Atlantic Division. Now, division play is different this year. The schedule's still unbalanced, but winning your division does not mean anything as far as your seeding in your conference. And the Eastern Conference is slightly better, if not significantly better, this season. Now, and they did beat the occasional Western Conference opponent last season, but that win against Oklahoma City, that win in Dallas against the Mavericks, are we still watching this team with a skeptical eye? Is there a little bit of that, or are we past that same feeling that we had a year ago?
I mean, I'm past the feeling in terms of, am I wondering if this is a good regular season team or not? I think they are. I think they proved that last year, and they're proving this year that they might be an even better regular season team just because of the improvements that they've made on defense and off the bench. But in general, you know, as Rory said, it's one of those things where we got to wait till April, and we could. I know we like to figure out what's wrong and what's right with teams, but this is one of those cases where you really could just enjoy the next 76 games and wake up and watch the playoffs and see how they do. Now, that's not the worst thing. I mean, for how long would we have killed to have a playoff hockey team in Toronto, you know? And now we're looking at it at the beginning of an NBA season saying, we got a playoff basketball team. Let's see what they can do come April. That's not something to be thrown away lightly. You know, it's great. It's good to make the playoffs. They'll have a good shot.
Kyle Lowry, so much was made of his offseason and losing the baby fat. He's no longer built, I guess, like a fire hydrant. He's a little more muscular. It's paid off early this season. He's had a couple of tremendous, tremendous games. That game in Dallas against the Mavericks was ridiculous. He was pretty good yesterday as well. Has he taken his game to the next level? What have you seen at a Kyle Lowry, Rory, and understanding that the second half of last season was lousy despite being an all-star last year?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think just the fact that Toronto has kind of arrived as a good regular season team. Like Lowry is the force behind that. So the fact that Toronto is as good as they are, I think, is a credit to Lowry and a sign of how far his game has come, how refined his game has become. I feel very confident having the ball in his hands. Whether or not DeRozan turns into the guy that you give the ball to at the end of the game, I feel confident with Lowry. I mean, that ball last year could have gone into. It was a tough play. Lowry drives the offense. Lowry drives that team, and I'm very confident in Lowry and how he's developed.
He's a good on-floor leader. I don't think there's any question about that. He's a good person to have to be the heart of your team. You know, he embodies it in kind of his attitude and the way he's willing to go to the floor for a ball, the way he's willing to take charge and be the guy who's sort of the point person for yelling at the refs or getting the team fired up. The personality is what you'd want to see from a floor general, and I mean, in that respect, I think he's done an excellent job. Whether he's going to be truly considered among the elite point guards of the NBA, I think that's still in question. He might have taken another step towards it this year, but again, it's one of those things that we'll see come the end of the year.
You mentioned Corey Joseph off to a nice start. The Toronto kid returning home as a free agent. He was expected to provide lots of great defense coming off the bench, but they've run a lot of two-guard sets with Joseph and Lowry. Joseph running the point and then Lowry playing off the ball. Joseph played 29 minutes coming off the bench yesterday, or on Friday, 7-9 shooting, 19 points. He still provided the defense. It is, and I know the Raptors, it seems like they really do target, or at least try to target the few Canadians playing in the NBA whenever they become available. And Anthony Bennett did get some burn yesterday, played 6 minutes as well, but it's nice that they have a Canadian who's actually an impact player, not a star player in Corey Joseph, but a guy who's provided some very valuable minutes already for this team.
Yeah, you need guys like that. It's a long season, and especially as we've seen with Kyle Lowry, who wore down as last year came to an end. You know, so if you have somebody like Joseph, who you can trust to start for a game or two when you need Lowry to get a break, or if Lowry doesn't have it for a particular night, you can sit him, and or you can play them together and take some of the ball handling duties off of Lowry. I think that two guard lineup is nice. It's scrappy. Joseph plays tough defense. Lowry's always in there trying to fight for rebounds. And it's a good lineup to match up with some other small ball units. And, you know, you don't really worry too much about size when they're on the floor because they both play a little bigger than they are.
Yeah, and we're, you know, again, getting back to the playoffs, like to win there, you're going to need that depth. It's nice to have those five guys you are going to throw on the floor in the dying minutes, and those are the guys you're going to turn to. But to stay in those games, to compete with the best teams in the Eastern Conference, you need the depth coming off the bench to keep you in the game when your starters are needing that rest. So it's good to have this early sign that I think they're going to need some more of these guys to step up in the coming months. But that's something that is of concern, and it's good to have Joseph doing what he's doing so far.
And as much as Grievous Vasquez was a fan favorite a year ago, total turnstile defensively on the perimeter, and Corey Joseph, at very worst, if he's not shooting as well as he has been early this season, going to provide some nice perimeter defense. So staying on the along the lines of defense, we know last year they were off to an identical 5-1 start, although they did not start the season 5-0. But they were 5-1. They were leading the Eastern Conference deep into November. And then things definitely tailed off second half of the season. Maybe part of it was Kyle Lowry and his play tailing off. And maybe part of it was the fact that they were a lousy defensive team all season last year. Even when they were 5-1, even when they were spectacular in November, they were getting it done offensively and just kind of getting away with this terrible defense. It's a totally different team this year, and there were questions as to whether this team could score enough, even with an improved defense, to compete in the Eastern Conference. What's more fun? Is it the team that has Lou Williams chucking it up from everywhere? And you know what? Sometimes they're going in. More often than not, they were at the beginning of the season last year. Or is it the team that grinds it out, that is difficult to play like this one is, that has a bunch of big dudes swatting balls in the lane? Bismack Biyombo has feet for hands, but he can protect the rim like few can in the NBA. Louis Scola has provided a nice little defensive push, and Damari Carroll, one of the best at his position.
You're asking me which is more fun. I think the offensive team is more fun for the 82-game regular season, but when you get into the playoffs, the defensive team is more fun because they might play more than four games.
Yeah, it's it seems like when it finally comes down to a half-court game, if you're a team that can protect the rim, that you can limit the opponent's offense, you're probably in better shape. We mentioned that this team is going to be judged on what it does in the postseason. And it's almost like the regular season doesn't matter. They're not the only team like that, right? Like, there's teams that have been there before.
The NBA regular season matters less than any regular season in pro sports. It's almost not worth watching unless you're just doing it to enjoy the games.
Well, that's what I want to get to. Now, maybe that's not as true in the Western Conference because, I mean, you would have said that last year as well in the Oklahoma City Thunder. And I know they were beset by injuries, but they missed the playoffs. And it's a dogfight in the West. Don't you think the Spurs would have really enjoyed missing the Clippers in the first round of the postseason with a better regular season? And you can't control who you face in the postseason, but maybe you should.
Yeah, I mean, that's to me what the NBA needs to do to really make the regular season matter a little bit more. It's nice that they've changed it for this year so that you no longer have division winners automatically guaranteed second overall in the conference and therefore a weaker matchup, especially when teams like the Raptors win a terrible division. But there's a theory that's been going around out there for a couple of years now that the top-seeded team should get first pick of who they play in the playoffs, and then the second team gets pick of the remaining teams. And honestly, especially in a league like the NBA, where team rivalries are so important and guys really get to dislike each other over the course of a full season, and, you know, disrespect is such a thing, and there's bulletin board material, like, that would be exciting. If they turned that in to a half-hour show 2 days before the playoffs started where a representative from each team got to come up and say, you know, the San Antonio Spurs elect to play the Phoenix Suns in the first round, and then you cut to the guy from Phoenix sitting there being like, yeah. Oh, you want us, huh? Mm-hmm. Like, that's what will create drama, because right now you're going in knowing that the Cavs and the Raptors and the Bulls will all be there, and they'll all kind of get who they get, and it'll be a weaker team, but they don't control the matchups. And to me, it just means that I will tune in for 6 or 7 regular season basketball games, and then I'll come back for the playoffs.
I would watch that half-hour show for sure. What I love about it is you always hear, don't give the other team bulletin board material. Well, that whole playoff setup is bulletin board material right there. That would be fantastic.
Can you imagine if the Raptors finished third in the East and the Cavs won and they said, we'll take the Raptors in the first round?
Sure.
Like, wow. Oh my goodness, the city would explode. Masai Ujiri would get another fine for sure.
Well, yeah, it kind of reminds you of a couple of years ago where the Nets kind of did finagle. They massaged their games at the end of the season to set up a matchup with the Raptors in the first round of the playoffs. Now, it almost blew up in their face because it went to a game 7. Yeah. The Raptors had the ball.
Then you're talking about them, you know, winning and losing basketball games based on who they want to play. Whereas this way, you can just win them all as much as you want, because then you get to pick who you want to play. Yeah. No more losing on purpose to settle into a better seed.
It seems like there needs to be a bigger reward for a better record during the regular season. And I don't think the playoffs are being reduced anytime soon. So you got to have something. I think that's a nice little wrinkle. I don't think we'll see it, though. When we come back, Blue Jays offseason rolling right along here. And Tony LaCava, he's had some real layups to start his career as interim GM of the Toronto Blue Jays, like exercising the options on Edwin Encarnacion and Jose Bautista, and to a lesser extent, R.A. Dickey. First real decision coming down on Friday, though, as the Blue Jays deciding to issue a qualifying offer to Marco Estrada. So if he becomes the first player in Major League history to accept one of these things, he'll be signed to a 1-year deal worth $15.8 million next year. And if he doesn't and he signs elsewhere, the Blue Jays get a draft pick. We'll talk about that and how the Blue Jays go about rebuilding the pitching staff next year, because the starting nine looks like it's already set in stone. Some real question marks coming out of the bullpen and in that starting rotation. That's coming up next. I'm Ben Ennis, alongside Rory Boylan and Jordan Heath Rawlings at Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Dave Serum.
With the 20th pick in the 2014 NBA Draft, the Toronto Raptors select Bruno Caboclo from São Paulo, Brazil.
What just happened?
This is the all-time swing for the fences pick. I'm blown away. I've been doing this for 10 years. This is, he's 2 years away from being 2 years away, and then we'll see. Oh.
Even Masai Ujiri admits that might be the most accurate thing said about Bruno Caboclo when the Raptors GM shocked the basketball world last year with his top pick. Within a matter of months, Caboclo had gone from a virtually unknown teenager in Brazil with less than 5 years' experience playing the game to a first-round NBA pick. Nobody, outside of a small group of NBA scouts and personnel, knew anything about him other than his Plastic Man limbs and natural shooting stroke. But the Raptors saw something in Bruno that no other team did, and they worked around the clock to make sure the rest of the league wouldn't find out exactly what that was. We went behind the scenes with Caboclo and the Raptors in the long game to find out why the team always knew that their diamond in the rough was worth the time and the risk.
That story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet magazine on newsstands now. And available on texture by next issue or by downloading the Sportsnet magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones. Road rage isn't just for cars anymore. Get yourself going with Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports. Download the Sportsnet app and listen to Sportsnet 590 The Fan. This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Annis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Rory Boylan. Blue Jays offseason rolling right along. It's going to be an interesting watch. So many question marks, so many moves that need to be made. Not so much with the starting nine, but the pitching. With the departures, at least of David Price, we think, and I guess we'll discuss that in the next 10 minutes, maybe the departure of Marco Estrada, with a whole bunch of departures in the bullpen. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. Now, step one has been completed on Friday. The Blue Jays offered a qualifying offer to Mr. Estrada after finishing fifth in the American League in ERA. That means that if he accepts, it's a $15.8 million one-year deal for next year, and if he declines and signs elsewhere, the Blue Jays are entitled to a draft pick as compensation for Mr. Estrada from the signing team. Now, nobody in the history of qualifying offers, which is just a couple of years, has ever accepted one of these things, because generally, if you're good enough to warrant a team risking paying you almost $16 million for 1 year, you're probably good enough to earn a multi-year deal, whether that's 25 to 30 million over a couple of years, or I think what we expect out of Marco Estrada, 3-4 years, 40 plus ish million dollars. But that's quite an incredible difference in opinion on Marco Estrada comparing where he was before the season, right? He was just a guy that they got for Adam Lind from the Milwaukee Brewers. He gave up all the home runs last year, 2 years ago in Milwaukee, led the National League in home runs allowed, was not even supposed to be in this rotation to start the season, was the sixth starter, the swing man. All of a sudden, he's good enough that the Blue Jays are fine with maybe paying him almost $16 million next year, Jordan.
Yeah, well, here's the thing about Marco Estrada is that he's found money for the Blue Jays this year. I mean, he was a warm body, like you said, that they got maybe to help in the bullpen, and turned in a great season, and that's fantastic. He was a big contributor to the fantastic run that the Jays had. But I think some other teams will look at some of the underlying numbers with Estrada before they give him a lot of money. I mean, I think his fielding independent pitching was around 4.4, which is not an exceptionally great number. The opponent's batting average on balls in play against him was the lowest in the league among starting pitchers, which would really make you nervous, especially because he's not a guy that breaks the radar gun. He's a guy that relies on deception and relies on his changeup and has historically given up a lot of home runs. And it seems like when you combine a really low BABIP with a guy who's historically given up a lot of home runs, you're kind of asking for regression. Now, the Jays had to make, don't get me wrong, the Jays had to make this qualifying offer because not doing it would send a terrible message about what's happening going into the offseason, how much money is available, whether or not the payroll cap is there. So you make the qualifying offer. If he takes it for 1 year, maybe you're overpaying him a bit and you kind of see if he can replicate the success. And if he signs elsewhere, you get a draft pick. But if you look at the underlying numbers combined with the fact that you would lose a draft pick to the Blue Jays if you signed him, I think you won't see teams lining up the same way you would expect them to line up for a guy with his season he just had.
Yeah, and because he was more than I think anybody expected this year, I mean, it's his time to cash in with some security where he might not make as much per season over a longer-term deal. It's time to get that security. When you have that opportunity as a professional athlete, you have to take it, because what if he gets injured next year? Then that just goes up into a puff of smoke.
What if he's just Marco Estrada next year?
Exactly. He has to cash in on this now. I'd be shocked if he took this qualifying offer. But if I'm the Jays, I think I might come back and try and get him anyway, because you need to fill out this pitching rotation somehow.
3 years, $30 million? Is that really an overpay? Even assuming he regresses a little bit to not being one of the six or seven best pitchers in the American League, if you can get a guy who's somewhere sort of halfway between historical Marco Estrada and last year's Marco Estrada, or $10 million a season as your third or fourth starter, you probably take it.
Well, can the Blue Jays afford to lose him? What do they do in that starting rotation if they lose him, Rory?
That's just it. It's another hole. You're already losing David Price. I mean, you're talking about bringing Sanchez and maybe Osuna up. I worry about relying on three young guys that much. I like all of them, but I worry about relying on those guys for 162 games. So you need another guy who's going to get some innings. You had to bring back R.A. Dickey for this very reason. He's going to eat up 200 innings for you. You need to bring back Estrada just so that he can get those innings for you. And if he does what he did this year again, I mean, that's, again, you're playing with house money there. That would be fantastic. But I see no way how you can't, if he doesn't accept the qualifying offer, how you don't try to get him back on a three-year deal. Because where else are you going to get a guy for that kind of money who's going to get these kind of innings potentially for you and potentially do what he did again this year, next year?
And I mean, if you're spending money, there are a lot of pitchers out there this year that you could spend some money on. But I think what we just talked about bringing Sanchez and Osuna out of the bullpen and relying on three young arms, I'm not so scared about relying on young pitching. I think if the pitchers are good enough, it can happen. You saw it with the Mets this year. The problem is that what would you say their weakness was in the playoffs? It was their bullpen. And now you're going to take the two most reliable arms out of their bullpen. Assuming Cecil's going to be back, he's probably your most reliable left-hander. But you're going to take the closer and the setup man out of the bullpen and put them in the rotation. You got to find replacements for those guys now, too. And that's not easy. And we saw that having a lockdown 7-8-9 is what can win you a World Series. So you see that, and then you decimate your own bullpen to fill your starting rotation. It doesn't strike me as a way to get off on the right foot.
To be fair, I think their downfall in the postseason was clutch hitting, and 0 for 12 with runners in scoring position in Game 6, probably driving that point home. Talking about that starting rotation, that pitching staff, Drew Hutchison is a guy that, well, it's pretty obvious to understand how much this team was relying on him when you look back at the fact he started opening day in New York against the Yankees. Actually had a nice little start, and you know, he had flashes this year. And before he was removed from the starting rotation, he had a couple of good starts, but certainly the season as a whole was a train wreck, despite all the wins, because we know how much that means. Not a whole heck of a lot. And he would have, I mean, it could have very easily been a 20-game winner if he had a half-decent season. He was brutal. But we mentioned it's going to be a difficult task for the Blue Jays to restock this starting rotation. Where do we see Drew Hutchison fitting in come spring training down at Dunedin?
I mean, I think you've got to give him a shot to rejoin the rotation. He was a guy that at this time last year, the Jays were banking on to be their lockdown number three starter, and it looked like, based on the end of 2014, that he would have the upside to be a number two starter. And, you know, he just fell apart. As Ben mentioned, the home road splits were really interesting to look at last year because he did.
But they
have
were the opposite 2 years ago.
Yeah. So he's a mystery. I mean, he's a guy that I don't think will ever be a top of the rotation starter. But, you know, assuming that Stroman is that, and then one of Sanchez or Asuna can take a couple of steps and maybe become, you know, a sort of top end of the rotation starter. Again, we're getting into fairy tales here. But Drew Hutchinson is a guy you would hope could be maybe a back end of the rotation starter, maybe a replacement for R.A. Dickey, that kind of workhorse guy who can pitch 200 innings, give you a sort of 3.8 to 4.2 ERA and give you a chance to win every night.
Yeah, just because he showed the flashes this year, that's why I wouldn't give up on him. He showed those flashes. He had a good year a couple of years ago. Like, he's got that potential still. I would be terrified of giving up on the guy right now. Maybe he's your Marco Estrada next year. Maybe he's the guy who comes out and, you know, he starts the year as the fifth guy in the rotation, but by the end of the year, he's starting, you know, third game of the playoffs for you or something like that. He has the potential to be this guy who comes out of nowhere and eats a ton of innings for you and gets you a bunch of wins and is maybe a guy you either start in the playoffs or bring out of the bullpen after a starter gets lit up in the first couple innings.
Yeah, you know, Jeff Blair wrote a story in Sportsnet magazine sort of back at the beginning of last season, or the season we just went through, about Drew Hutchinson and about how he's sort of a wise old soul for somebody so young, and he really kind of takes it as it comes, and he doesn't dwell on his struggles, and he's willing to sort of move through them. And he acknowledged this was sort of as the season was starting to unravel for him. He acknowledged that he'd had some tough outings, and he did seem to have the kind of mentality you would need to sort of erase what's happened this year, wipe the slate clean, go back and rework his mechanics maybe, or try to find what went wrong, because it did seem like something just wasn't right. We didn't hear anything about him being hurt or him being sort of out of sync, but it's tough to go from what we saw at the end of 2014 to what we saw at the beginning of this season and not think something was amiss somewhere.
Yeah, it seemed like too much went wrong for it not to be a little bit better at least next season. Talking to Rory Boyle and Jordan Heath Rawlings, I'm Ben Ennis at Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. So we're still kind of getting an idea of how Mark Shapiro is going to run this organization, and so much was made of trying to understand his take on young players, on the farm system, on restocking the cupboard with young players after a few of them, more than a few of them, were dealt away at last year's non-waiver trade deadline. And he mentioned, yeah, we're in win-now mode. There's no question about that. But part of this organization's focus the coming years will be restocking that farm system. Can you do both, Rory?
It's going to be very hard to do both. And I think this is what, at Shapiro's opening presser, worried a lot of Jays fans. First of all, they're already angry that Alex Anthopoulos is gone. And now you have Shapiro coming in, and nobody wants him to mess with Alex's team. This is a great team that finally gives a lot of excitement to the city. And in Shapiro's opening presser, he's talking about how the Blue Jays don't have the high-end talent in their system anymore. And that just that sends alarm bells, because he's not wrong. It's just not what Jays fans want to hear right now. Because when you think, when you hear a guy like that talking about needing to get that high-end talent, well, how are you going to do that? Who are you going to trade to get that when you already need starting pitching? Your lineup is stacked. Who is it that you're going to lose? What do you mean you need high-end talent? We want a World Series. We want to see how far we can take this team while we have these players in their primes. So you're talking about needing to stock that farm system at the high end. How do you do that? How do you do that without losing something off this team? I don't think it's possible.
Well, I think the first name that came to everybody's lips when he sort of said that was Troy Tulowitzki, because he's a guy who is a superstar, who's got years left on his contract, who, if healthy, is signed for a relatively affordable price, given what a talent he is. I'm not certainly sitting here saying the Blue Jays should trade Tulowitzki and retool, but I think they have a window of one more year. I think anybody could look at this team and see how the contracts are structured. I don't think they have really anybody on big money deals beyond this year except for Russell Martin. Now, Donaldson will still be under team control. Stroman obviously has years of service left. But, you know, Russell Martin is their big guy who's under a big contract. Batista and Edwin and all those guys are kind of going off at the end of this season. Tulowitzki will be around, assuming they keep him. But now would be a time to really go for it this coming year. And maybe that means you have to look at what happened the last half of last season, look at the kind of money it made for ownership, look at the kind of excitement it generated. You know, they're going to raise ticket prices for next year. They're going to end their ballpark pass program that got me $1 tickets for Lord knows how long. And
you've been mooching. Yeah,
I've been mooching.
Is over.
I'm out. My days are done. But, you know, if they can keep this team exciting, that won't matter because fans will be lining up to buy these tickets. We've already seen that. The question is how much did they realize that they can spend money to make money, and how much are they willing to put it in and go all out for this season when the window's still open?
It's hard to imagine this team slashing payroll in a significant way considering how this season went, right? Like that, I know there's been some speculation in that regard. I guess it's possible. Anything's possible, especially considering the state of the Canadian dollar, but you'd figure with what this team did as far as making Rogers money second half of last season, it seems like you got to capitalize on this momentum.
And with Anthopoulos leaving, already kind of leaving fans with a bitter taste in their mouth. Now, I personally don't mind so much that Anthopoulos left, but I don't want to get into, you know, was it Anthopoulos or Shapiro or whatever? But I think that you have to send a message to the fans that this owner cares about this team, that they want this team to be good, that they're willing to spend money to make it happen, because we saw that fans are willing to spend money to see it.
Yeah, I mean, you have all this momentum. You have all this goodwill that you've built up. I mean, to suddenly willingly tear down at least a little bit to do whatever for the future. I mean, this team for 20 years has been about the future. Look at our prospects. Look at our good young arms that we've got. And now you're in this situation, like you said, take one more run at it. Because if you do make a trade that people look at as, oh, they're taking a step back, well, Rogers Center is not going to – it's not going to be long till it's – empty again.
If you don't strike while the iron is hot, what are you even doing it for? Why are you even fielding a baseball team if you can't have the best offense in Major League Baseball and not go out and spend to get some pitching? You got to seriously rethink your priorities if you're not willing to do that.
Going to be a fun offseason for the Toronto Blue Jays. When we come back, we'll get into the Edmonton Oilers and life without Connor McDavid, who has a broken clavicle, and that makes us all sad. But Jordan Eberle's back, so that makes us happy, sort of, kind of. Got a nice beard.
Not as happy as we could have been.
No. I mean, and we're starting at a very low level of happiness anyways, because it gets dark at 4:30 in the afternoon. So we'll talk about Connor McDavid and the Edmonton Oilers, also the Maple Leafs, with another strong effort, but another loss. And maybe expanding the nets is a way to up scoring in the National Hockey League. All that and plenty more coming up as we go forward for the next hour. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Rory Boylan at Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Send us all your money. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher, and we'll send you a free subscription for Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand, absolutely free. It's a magazine you don't have to feel obligated to buy from your nephew's fundraiser. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, free on your radio. Now. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis alongside Rory Boylan and Jordan Heath Rawlings. NHL season rolling right along, and it's still a fun season. It'll still be a fun finish. But it's not quite as fun without Connor McDavid, who's out for a couple of months, we think at least, with the Edmonton Oilers with that broken collarbone. Oilers played their first game without him yesterday, losing 2-1 to the Pittsburgh Penguins. Jordan Eberle returned. I don't know what else there is to say about this, Rory, other than it just kind of makes us sad that the Connor McDavid train just barely left the station and already it's been derailed.
And he left us wanting so much more. I mean, 12 points in 13 games after a slow start. He started the first couple of games there without any points and maybe a little... nervous, tentative, whatever, but the fact that he was able to speed it up so much, I mean, this guy showed in the little bit that we've seen that he is the real deal, that he is different than any rookie we've seen since maybe Sidney Crosby. I can't think of another rookie in there who's been that productive and looked that good. He looks so smooth. He's not the most physical player, but he doesn't need to be. Like, he sees the ice well. His speed is incredible. It's absolutely incredible. And you think, since Eberle just came back last night, the fact that he could have been playing with Jordan Eberle and made the two of them coming off of each other would have been incredible too. But it's too bad. But I mean, I wouldn't rule him out for winning the Calder yet. I think he could still come back and go on a major tear if he's only out for 2 months. Any longer than that, it'll be hard. But that's how good this guy is. Some of the other rookies will slow down, I think, because that's what rookies do. They're mostly the top guys will score in the 50, 60-point range. But McDavid could score at a point-per-game pace when he gets back.
Yeah, I mean, that injury is the 4:30 sunset of my sports life. It's just, like, sucks sucks so much out of my enjoyment of watching that team. The Edmonton Oilers had become must-see TV.
Yep.
They had become, you know, that one team where you're like, oh, that game starts at, like, 9:30 tonight. Okay, well, I guess I'm staying up till midnight, right? Mm. It was almost something that was becoming a phenomenon. And, you know, don't get me wrong, still lots on that team worth watching. Lots of flashy young players. The defense is not good, so you're probably going to see some goals. It's just depressing. I mean, it's really tough for the NHL. They had what was becoming a crossover talent, you know, one of those guys that people in the U.S. hear about. And, you know, you tell your friend who might not like hockey so much. I know you don't like hockey. You don't care about the Edmonton Oilers, but check this kid out, you know. And anytime a sport, whatever sport it is, loses a talent like that, you kind of got to just hang your head. But, you know, we've seen clavicle injuries before. Tony Romo's suffering through his second one right now with the Cowboys. If everything breaks right, they can only take about 8 weeks. I know they said, you know, three months plus, just because you obviously want to be careful with the future of your franchise. But at the same time, Mark Spector reported yesterday that the surgery went as well as could possibly be expected. And, you know, we saw last year that he healed pretty quickly from his broken hand and that he's got the right attitude about it. So, you know, let's all cross our fingers and hopefully we get a nice New Year's gift.
The Oilers are probably sick of moral victories and talk of it. But Todd McLellan and did couch it a little bit. He said, I know we can't be talking about moral victories or effort level. It's about victories at some point. But he's new to the situation. There's a new brain trust in Edmonton. Is it okay, Rory, that they're still talking about moral victories and being not satisfied with the 2-1 loss to the Pittsburgh Penguins, but being satisfied with the effort level?
Yes, to a degree. You can't start accepting that if you're losing too much. But so far, this Oilers team looks different. I mean, even though you're without Connor McDavid now, you still have Taylor Hall playing very, very well. You have Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. I mean, that guy could score more than 82 points. That guy could be right up there in the scoring lead. And then you have this another kid that stepped into that second line center role, Leon Draisaitl, now 7 points in 4 games. I mean, there's a lot of potential here. It's about, you know, you have a new coach in there with some success in his past. It's about installing a system where you don't give up, where you keep pushing. And they did hang with the Pittsburgh Penguins last night, even though they lost. It was a really good game. It's just not accepting losing anymore. That's a really tough cycle to break out of. And that's why, you know, you hear all the time, especially in Toronto here, about willingly going into a rebuild and totally blowing it up and bottoming out for a couple of years so you can get an Austin Matthews-type player at the top of the draft. Well, that's nice in theory, but it's a really, really tough cycle to break out of because, as we've seen with the Oilers, they've been bad for a number of years. They've got four first overall picks, but they don't have the defense. They didn't draft well in the depth rounds, the second, third, fourth rounds, and that's why the team hasn't been able to push forward. And it's this losing culture that kind of drains on you, and it's really, really, it's harder to break out of in reality than when you think about it. You think, oh, well, you get enough of this talent, you're just going to start winning. It's not that simple. It's really not that simple.
Well, I am excitedly waiting for Oilers versus Leafs moral victory Stanley Cup final.
Oh,
you know,
man.
7 moral games, 1 moral champion.
Don't even keep score, right?
Yeah, no, you do keep score. You keep score of effort.
Yeah, that's right.
The harder you try, the more goals it counts for. And, you know, if you get an A for effort, that means you scored. The Oilers have success on the ice to a limited degree this season. Mm-hmm. They're a 500 team when Connor McDavid went down. And, I mean, for the Oilers, that's progress. And you can't really judge a team on what they do this next month sort of as they, you know, adjust to life without the guy they built around this year. I don't think anybody would be surprised to find them in the lottery next year. And obviously that's a failure to one degree. On the other hand, you know, then they add another nice piece. And at some point you got to figure that they reach a tipping point. This is probably about the third year in a row we could have said, you know, at some point they'll reach a tipping point with the talent. But, you know, that's one way to rebuild a franchise. The Leafs' way is to just get rid of everybody and hope that you can find some talent and instill a system and get it going. And, you know, I constantly come back because we were reminded when we watched the two teams play last night is that the Leafs get to be so terrible forever and the Red Wings end up with Dylan Larkin. It's an unfair sports universe.
And what were we expecting from the Oilers this year anyway? Was anybody really picking them to make the playoffs? I mean, I don't think so. That, first of all, the Central Division on the, you know, the other division in the West there is incredible.
There's five teams.
There's six contenders.
Maybe six, yeah.
Five are going to make the playoffs. Somebody's going to be left out. Then you're going to have three teams in Edmonton's Pacific Division there, which you have to think, even though they're starting slow, are Anaheim and then LA. I would pick San Jose, but Vancouver's kind of hanging around there, too.
Sure. Isn't Dallas in that division as well?
Dallas is Central. Dallas is, I mean, there's some must-watch TV. Speaking of must-watch TV,
no
Dallas
kidding.
Stars. But so what were we expecting from the Edmonton Oilers? Is it a failure if they finish 10th in the West? I don't think so. I think that would be a nice push forward for the Oilers, that they're showing that they're kind of
getting out
of
this. I thought you were going to say it was going to be a moral victory to finish in 10th. I would have said, before the season started, I probably would have said it would not shock me at all for the Oilers to compete for a playoff spot. I don't think I would have picked them to make it, but I would have expected them to sort of be in it in the final month and, you know, for Connor McDavid to really be gelling with his line mates. And you know, you look at that roster with or without Connor McDavid, that's a roster that you're looking at and you're saying, okay, they'll win when they outscore the opponent. And if they can't, you know, if they can't keep them under 4 goals a game, you know, they're going to lose. And they can't do that very often.
No. And this time last year, they were already out. So yeah. Progress.
Yeah, I guess. Even though you're talking about the fifth worst record in the NHL, the Edmonton Oilers holding down. I know it's very early, and we're talking about a new brain trust with Peter Chiarelli and Todd McClellan here. But the question will always be raised, which one of these young players are they going to trade away, if any? And you mentioned Leon Draisaitl off to a nice little start there. Is that a guy that makes sense?
Yeah, so to me, Jordan Eberle is always the guy who's rumored. But to me, I would, and you don't have to rush into this as the Edmonton Oilers. You have time because you weren't going to make the playoffs this year. You want to pick your spot and make sure that you make the right move here. But to me, Leon Draisaitl is the guy that you look at moving, only because when you think of the most valuable trade chip that you can have in the NHL, it's either a number one defenseman or a big centerman who can play top line, maybe second line. And Leon Draisaitl looks like that guy. So, you know, the silver lining here, if there is one, for the Oilers is now you have Draisaitl able to move off the wing back to his natural position down the middle. And last night he's playing with Taylor Hall and Jordan Eberle, so he's got some really nice talent around him. And if you stick him there for the next 2 months and he plays really well and he keeps putting up these points, well, suddenly his stock is absolutely through the roof. And again, you don't want to rush in. You want to make sure you're getting the relatively young top number one center or defenseman that you can get, which you really need on that team to round it out. But I think, yeah, you can trade Jordan Eberle for a pretty good return, but he's making $6 million for the next couple of years. There's some concern about his all-around play and what he really is. But at least for the Oilers, he's a winger. You are strong down the middle. Use that to your advantage. And Draisaitl could be the guy that you can get that home run trade with.
I mean, you can hope for it. The issue for me is when you look at NHL teams, you're right, there's probably 10 or 15 teams in the NHL for whom Draisaitl would be their best center prospect by far and probably, you know, have the hopes pinned on him as a number one center of the future and a guy you can build around. The problem is that there's only really like 10 to 15 teams in the entire NHL that have that number one young defenseman that you're looking for. Like, those guys are precious, and teams aren't willing to give him up. You're right that Draisaitl may be, you know, sort of a guy like that would be the one trade chip you can convince them to part with it. But, I mean, I'm trying to just think right now of teams that have a guy like that? Would you like Draisaitl for Noah Hanifin? Maybe
you know what? That's exactly what I was thinking when I was going through this. Was Hanifin is maybe a guy you could probably maybe Justin Falk if they like Hanifin more. I don't know. You can kind of explore that. I'd also, I mean, if the St. Louis Blues don't pull through this year, they're gonna change something. You would think, and they have an awful lot of defensemen. I would kind of sniff around there to see what they've got too. Obviously, it would never happen. Calgary would kind of, you know, they have a lot too, but that trade just couldn't possibly happen.
Draisaitl for Dougie Hamilton.
Yeah, right.
Well, but was Dougie, would you even take Hamilton in return for Draisaitl
now? No, I wouldn't. Not right now. And this is the thing, like, who would have imagined Dougie Hamilton would have been traded when he was? Like, nobody was thinking Dougie Hamilton was going to get traded. So it's not impossible that somebody is going to come available out of the blue that right now we can't think about. But, you know, around the draft when crazy things happen that, oh, I can't believe the Oilers just acquired this guy. Nobody was even tossing this guy's name out there. But that's when the team, I think that's when the trade has to happen. If one happens, is around the draft. That's basically when all the excitement happens.
And I think that if it happens, it's going to be, you know, I just think guys like Hanifin, as well as I think that that might be a willing trade partner. I think that teams with guys like that, especially young defensemen on controllable contracts, are not willing to trade them. I think if you're looking at what they're going to acquire, I would bet that it would be a similar young guy with talent, but a young guy that's already maybe signed at least that bridge contract and is at least, so the team getting Draisaitl can say, you know, well, we're taking a forward in exchange for our best young defenseman, but we're also clearing some space and we're also preparing to, you know, sign somebody else to replace him. I think you're going to look at that and people are going to be wanting the Oilers to take salary in a deal like that.
It's worth noting in Carolina too that Eric Staal is on an expiring contract, and if they can't sign him, then suddenly I guess Jordan Staal is now your top line center, so now you have a hole at center.
Gigantic
yeah,
huge hole.
This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Rory Boylan. Pittsburgh Penguins win that game 2-1. This is how they win hockey games now. Sidney Crosby still sitting on two goals as we're through 14 games this regular season. I guess on the one hand, that's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of goals to come for Sidney Crosby in one
You'd
sense.
You,
oh, I mean, I it's not even think. I don't think anybody would look at his performance in his history and doubt that they're going to come unless there's something really wrong with him that nobody's talking about, which we obviously haven't heard anything about. He's still getting his chances, too. You can watch almost a five-minute video compilation of Sidney Crosby being snake-bitten on chances from the slot and in close-range areas. But, yeah, you know, the Penguins have it's so incongruous to think of that they've become this team which, you know, takes shots from the perimeter and sort of peels back into a little bit of a shell and tries to win this way, because going into this season, you'd look at them and be like, that's one of the top five offenses in hockey, and it's defense and goaltending that are going to be their questions. And the defense has been middling, and they've had to work around it. Marc-Andre Fleury's been their best player, and, you know, he doesn't get a lot of credit. He often, in fact, takes a lot of heat for his playoff performances, but he's been their best player by far thus far, and that's not a good look for the Penguins. It's not a healthy thing, for sure.
And that's the funny thing is, since the Penguins traded Simone Dupree last year, I mean, their defense has been a joke. When that trade happened, it's like, what are you doing? This is the best young defenseman that you have that you can at least move forward with, and now you have nothing. Chris Letang is great, but Chris Letang has had injury concerns in the past couple of years.
He's a concussion away from missing the rest of the year.
Exactly. And then where are you left? So the fact that they're winning this by defense is mind-boggling. Nobody saw this coming. And it's great to see Marc-Andre Fleury being their best player, because he has taken a lot of heat over the past couple of years with his playoff failures. But when it comes to the regular season, like, the guy is always there. How many goalies are out there that you can rely on like this in the regular season to win you games when you're struggling like the Penguins are on offense? It's few and far between. When you're talking about the best goalies in the game, you're talking about, you know, Lundqvist and Price and those guys. But the guys that are really valuable are the guys who you know exactly what you're going to get out of every single year. And Fleury is one of those
guys. You know what Marc-Andre Fleury is? Now, just a multi-sport comparison here. He's R.A. Dickey and Mark Burley. He's an innings eater. You know, he can come out there and he plays on back-to-back nights, and he's ready to go, and he never complains, and he's always going to go out there and give you a solid effort. You might put four goals by him one night, but, you know, the next night he will come right back, and he'll, you know, give you a one-goal or a two-goal effort and give you a chance chance to win. And for a team like the Penguins that's sort of struggling in transition and trying to find an identity, that is so valuable, because I promise you that Sidney Crosby will figure it out. I promise you, well, I won't promise you that Phil Kessel will go within 20 feet of the net, but I promise you that he'll score some from about 20 feet out. And, you know, I promise that Evgeny Malkin, who's already had a decent start, will get better as well. And, you know, when we look back at this, you know, in March and April, and we'll be surprised at how well Marc-Andre Fleury carried them when they needed him to.
We were talking about moral victories with the Edmonton Oilers. The leader in the clubhouse for moral victories is the team with the fewest points this NHL season, the Toronto Maple Leafs, stuck on 7 and just 2 wins as they lose on Friday 2-1 in overtime to the Detroit Red Wings. Jakob Kindl with his second of the season. Henrik Zetterberg opened the scoring in a shot from the blue line that was totally mishandled by James Reimer. I know they're bad. They're not good, are the Maple Leafs. But I can't help but think that they're better than 7 points and Buffalo Sabres of 2014-2015 bad, Rory.
They're better than their record is showing right now. All the underlying numbers are positive, which doesn't mean anything on the scoreboard or in the standings right now, but it means that it's likely to get better. I mean, Exhibit A of this is Nazem Kadri. He's piling the shots on net, and he's not scoring on any of them yet, but it's going to come. I think there's going to be more offense to come from James Van Riemsdyk. Now, they don't have the depth of talent that you need to get you through these kind of dry spells, but it's going to get better. They're going to catch on to Mike Babcock's system. They're going to get settled into that. The goals are going to start going in. They're not going to make the playoffs or anything. At the start of the season, I had them kind of in that 10 to 12 range in the Eastern Conference.
Going to drop that down a little bit?
Maybe a little bit, but they're not this bad. They're not as bad as they are right now. Philadelphia, New Jersey, Carolina, they're all in the other division in the East, but I think they're all worse than Toronto. I would be shocked if Toronto, unless they win a lottery, ends up with Austin Matthews. I don't think they're 30th bad. They're going to start winning some games. They're not even Buffalo last year bad, but they don't have that depth. So there's going to be these long dry spells that they go through.
Well, it's not even just about not having the depth. It's about not having the top line talent, right? Like that's what this team is
although
missing.
Although Kadri's pretty good.
Hey, Kadri's a great player, and you know, if you can buy low on him in fantasy, because you can probably get him for not very much right now, absolutely, you know, do it, because the goals are coming. The numbers, underlying numbers are great. He's way up there. I think he's in the top 5 in the league in shots right now. But the top-line talent is just not really there beyond that. And last night was a really good example, because the Detroit Red Wings are really struggling right now. They're at the bottom of the league in possession numbers, and they're really finding it tough to adjust to a new system. There's a lot of young kids who are playing in Grand Rapids last year who are now being asked to, you know, match up against veterans in the NHL, and it's tough for them. And the Leafs outplayed them last night. It wasn't even that close in terms of the shot count, but the Red Wings just have more talent, and you saw it in overtime when it was 3-on-3, you know, and the Leafs threw out Kadri and Van Riemsdyk early, and then, you know, they made a couple of changes, and then all of a sudden it's P.A. Parenteau and somebody else against, you know, Nyquist and Tatar and Zetterberg.
It would have been a novel idea to play some sort of defense on that Jakob Kindl goal, though.
Yeah, well, that's going to happen. That's one of the things that makes 3-on-3 so exciting. You know, it's easy to burn Gardner for that, but what Gardner was doing is what has been drilled into him since, you know, he was a kid. Watch for the guy joining the rush and let your goalie play the slot. He forgot for a minute that there was nobody else joining the rush because he's not used to playing 3-on-3, and you're going to see that in 3-on-3. It's what makes it so much fun. But, like, yeah, if you look on the ice last night, the Leafs were the better team. If you look at the roster, the Red Wings have the game breakers.
They do, and they use them on Friday night to beat the Maple Leafs. What do the Maple Leafs do in goal here? Because we've seen James Reimer now take the reins with Jonathan Bernier on the IR. Antoine Bebo is up as the emergency call-up. He's had a nice little season with the Marlies. It is all about the future for the Toronto Maple Leafs, and they won't call up any of the real promising young players. William Nylander, you would expect, will be down at RICO the entire season. Mitch Marner is going to be in London. That's not changing anytime soon. But Bebo's not a guy we mention when we talk about the young, promising players that are the future of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Should he be? Do we know much about him? Or is it just the nature of goalie prospects that it's, you just throw darts at a board and you hope one of them sticks?
I mean, I don't think you're too far off from saying that. And a guy like Bebo, you just don't know until you see him in the NHL. I think one thing we've seen a decent amount of in the league lately is goaltending tandems and riding the hot hand. And, you know, I think as Rory said earlier, when you're looking at the elite goalies in the NHL, you know, you can probably count them on two hands. Like, there's no more than 10 of them, really. And, you know, look at a team like the Leafs were playing last night in Detroit. They don't have a number one goalie, really. They got two goalies, and they're both good. But you wouldn't look at either of them and be like, oh, yeah, you know, this guy is fantastic. Mrazek showed flashes. But the Leafs, you don't know what you have with Bernier and Reimer, and you especially don't know what you have with Bebo. And it's not like you have designs on a playoff spot or a long winning streak. So if Bebo comes up there and he flops, it gets you a little closer to Auston Matthews. And if he comes up here and he shines, well, then maybe you have a chip to work with. And maybe Bernier or Reimer could be trade chips.
Yeah, give him a shot while you have this window where one of the goalies on your pro roster is injured. You might as well see what you got. Ben, you're right. Like, goalies are such wild cards. You can't bank on their potential or anything. I mean, I remember Jacob Markstrom for the longest time was the goalie of the future for Florida, and they gave up on him, and he's still unproven at the NHL level. But he was the star. He was the next big guy. And meanwhile, Vancouver has a guy named Eddie Lack come out of nowhere and perform very well. They ended up giving up on him anyways, but that's what Vancouver does with goalies. Give Bebo a shot, see what he's got. If he performs really well, then maybe you have something there. You can ride him a little longer. But when Bernier gets back and you're going with Bernier and Reimer, I think you do have to go with the hot hand. I think they want Bernier to be the guy, and they've wanted him to be the guy since he got here. They invested a lot to bring him in, but he just hasn't done it.
That ship has sailed for me. I can't imagine him being a starting number one on a good team.
But the thing is, he's never had a very good team in front of him either. So it's hard to judge. He could go somewhere else and end up being this guy. I'm not sold on him. I'm not sold on Reimer either. But what is Reimer? Like, Reimer's been just as good. He's been fine. Mm-hmm. You don't have a star goalie here, and that's why I think you got to ride the hot hand until you find the guy who you're going to move forward with. I don't think either of these guys is the guy that you're going to go with when this team finally does kind of emerge from this darkness that they're in.
When is that?
Yeah, who knows?
Oh, man. Who knows?
Years and years, and who knows if Nazem Kadri will be a part of it when it does happen. We assume it will happen at
he
some point in the next decade.
He might be an old man by the time it happens.
Right. He may be in the broadcast booth, but he's still stuck on one goal. But just like the Maple Leafs, it's difficult to assess their success level on the scoreboard in the standings. Is it also difficult to assess how well Nazem Kadri has played if you're just looking at the stat line?
Yeah, Nazem Kadri. The Leafs have had a lot of moral victories, and Nazem Kadri's had a lot of moral goals.
Yeah.
He's putting the puck on net. He's getting to the tough areas. You see him driving the net. You see him drawing penalties. He does a heck of a lot of things that are giving the Leafs a chance to win games. It's not coming through for them right now, and that's not the biggest deal because it's not part of the plan anyway. But like we said earlier, you know, he's playing in such a way that when the dam finally breaks, I think you're going to see a few multi-point nights from him.
Yeah, he's the best of what they have. And for, you know, a long time, he was kind of behind Tyler Bozak. Bozak was getting better minutes than Kadri was. And now that you're seeing Kadri with this horrible team around him, it's all these underlying numbers, like, you know, this guy's not so bad. Why wasn't this guy getting these minutes before? And some people were asking that question when it was happening, and you couldn't imagine, why is Tyler Bozak getting all these minutes?
But Kadri can win faceoffs now,
yeah,
which is something that he wasn't doing before, which is why Bozak was getting so many more minutes than him. But he's 51%, I think, this year in the faceoff circle, and that makes a huge difference towards Babcock being willing to throw him on the ice.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Babcock is a guy that's obviously well-respected in hockey circles, and once again named the head coach of Team Canada for the upcoming World Cup of Hockey. Not surprisingly, Joel Quenneville, part of his staff, making that the first experience he's had under Mr. Babcock as a part of the coaching staff for Team Canada. But mentioning that when Mike Babcock talks, people listen. He's not the first. He's not the only guy to say, hey, maybe expanding the nets would make a little bit of sense. Now, it sounds funny coming from the guy who's the head coach of the Toronto Maple Leafs, who have such an issue scoring goals. But Rory, is he on to something?
Now, I'm going to preface this by saying I think they will make the nets bigger at some point in the future, but I don't like the idea. To me, and this goes back to when we were coming out of the 04-05 lockout, it's about calling the rule book. You can always come up with a standard to call the game a certain way that creates offense. Coming out of 04-05, it was probably too much. You were getting a ton of power plays. Every little stick thing, whether it was involved in the play or not, was getting called. There were power plays everywhere. Goals being scored all over the place, and it's kind of gone down ever since then. But what I think they've lost, well, I wouldn't call these little stick infractions that are inconsequential away from the play. I think what they've really gotten away from that they need to get back to is calling those sticks on the hands when a guy has a scoring opportunity. When a guy has that shot, when he has that opening, if you get on him at all, that should be a penalty as tight as it was being called in 05-06. That's kind of what they've lost, and I think if you really crack down on that again, first of all, the players will learn and stop taking those penalties, but you'll get those power plays, you'll create more chances, and to me, that's the answer here, is just call the rule book.
Is it an issue? Is it enough of an issue to make a drastic move like expanding the nets, Jordan? Is it a problem in your eyes? Because, I'm not one of those guys that says, hey, you got to have 5-4 games. It's got to be the 80s again, because you can have a real entertaining scoreless game into overtime like the Ducks and Blackhawks played a couple of weeks ago. But you look at the numbers, and it's just a fact. Scoring is down, and scoring sells, I guess. Is it a problem enough that you need to make a big move like that?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of a problem. Let's not overstate it, though. I think we had a Blackhawks-Blues game that was 5-5 after two periods the other day. But see, there you go, Rory. Your attitude was, that was awesome.
Hey, but there was a low-scoring Anaheim Florida game I love too.
You're a special man. Yeah. But no, honestly, I'm going to hot take right back, because I think that we should make the Nets bigger. And not because it's this huge, terrifying problem that people are going to stop watching if scoring doesn't shoot through the roof, but because it's fun and because it helps the product. And while I agree with you that calling it by the rule book and calling these stick infractions would absolutely maybe accomplish the same thing, it accomplished it by then making us play 5-on-4 for about half the game. You know, we saw that, I think, after the lockout, that so many penalties were being called that really the teams with the best special teams were the teams that were going far in the playoffs and the teams that were winning divisions. And I don't know if you want to go down that road towards making special teams an even more important part of hockey. For me, as a guy who's an NFL writer by trade, the one thing that I really like about the NFL, and Lord knows they have problems running their league, is that they're not afraid to make quick changes to the game to improve the fan experience. You know, they do it almost every year now. They did overtime a couple years ago. They did moving the extra point back this year. You know, they've done moving the kickoff distance back to keep the players safer. They don't stop tinkering with it. And that's a thing that I think some people who follow the NHL, that's anathema to them, and they don't want to see this game changed in any way. But I mean, I promise you, after the first 2 months of uproar about making the Nets big, everybody would just go back to forgetting about it, and all of a sudden we'd see some more pucks go in.
But we can all agree 3-on-3 overtime is amazing, and it needs to be expanded to, like, I don't know, 20 minutes at least. Like, there would be no games that go to shootouts if it was 20 minutes.
Get rid of the
long.
Shootout. Get have 3-on-3 for 10 minutes. Although, if anybody's watched the Ottawa Senators in 3-on-3, they are really good at ruining
it.
They are really good at ruining 3-on-3 excitement.
Yeah, and they're the only team that's able and capable of doing so, but maybe we'll see a trend in that direction. When we come back, we're well past now the halfway mark of the NFL season. It's week 9, which is kind of crazy. We'll have a look at some of the games coming up. Also, the Dallas Cowboys and their treatment of the Greg Hardy situation has not been great. And maybe that's the understatement of the year. And now there's even more pressure on that team to do something after the photos were released. We'll talk about that also. Johnny Manziel didn't throw an interception. I guess that's a step in the right direction. Not nearly as bad as his week 15 against the Bengals last week, but still lost on Thursday to the Cincinnati Bengals. All that and plenty more coming up next. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Rory Boylan and Jordan Heath Rawlings at Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Ryan Dixon.
In rugged Shea Weber and underrated Roman Josi, the Nashville Predators have the premier defense pairing in the NHL. As if that's not enough, the Preds also boast another emerging force on the blue line in the form of 6'4" Seth Jones. Despite the fact his dad, Popeye Jones, was an 11-year NBA veteran, Seth's heart always belonged to hockey, mostly because of its frantic pace.
You know, there could be minutes at a time where the play doesn't stop. And that's kind of the exciting thing is, You can't really, you know, you can't really blink, or you can't really leave the TV, or else, you know, you might miss something.
Jones's development has taken more of a slow and steady look, playing behind that minute-munching top pair. But now in his third NHL season, Jones is seeing more of the ice and playing in all situations. That could be bad news for opposing coaches like Edmonton's Todd McClellan, who is struck by how good of a skater Jones is despite his size.
He can really get around the rink with that big frame, but when you're not moving, you're able to play in one area, and he's still got good range. He's got reach.
Where can all that ability take Jones? We're only just starting to find out. But if he gets where most expect him to go, Nashville will have a big three on the blue line that outshines anything else in the league.
That story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet magazine on newsstands now. And available on texture by next issue or by downloading the Sportsnet magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones. Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Rory Boylan and Jordan Heath Rawlings. NFL Week 9 as we roll right along, well past the midway point of the NFL season, which is kind of sad in a couple of different ways. But yes, things certainly getting interesting. We'll talk about matters on the field in just a second. But Jordan, we got to start with the Dallas Cowboys and Greg Hardy. You've got a story out on the website right now. There's not too many diverging opinions on Mr. Hardy. He's a scumbag. Everybody knows he's a scumbag. There have now been pictures released of his domestic incident. I guess we shouldn't be shocked that the Cowboys are not moving away from Greg Hardy now, because it shouldn't be a shock when we see the photos. I mean, the reports are more damning than even the photos, even. So the Cowboys shouldn't be surprised at what they got themselves into. It's just it's an ugly, ugly look for the NFL and the Dallas Cowboys.
It's a terrible look for the NFL. It's a worse look for the Cowboys. But you can't expect them to back down now. I mean, it's not like we didn't know what Greg Hardy had done. There were court transcripts. Everybody knew. Everybody was talking about it. Everybody said this guy should be kicked out of football forever. And the Dallas Cowboys stepped right in and signed them, which continues basically a tradition that dates back to the early 1990s of the Dallas Cowboys putting winning ahead of everything else, even when it means not only employing questionable characters, which, you know, let's be real, every team in sports does at some point or another, but enabling them by putting them on the field and putting them in a position to succeed and redeem themselves, yes, but also allowing them to do things off the field that just contribute to this attitude that's, it's killing sports. It's killing the NFL for sure, because the NFL has a real image problem right now led by people like Hardy. But not only that, is Jerry Jones is one of the leading voices in all the NFL meetings. He's one of the older statesmen of this league. And if you have an older statesman of your league going out and calling a domestic abuser and somebody who is basically reviled by everybody else in the sports world a real team leader, while simultaneously cutting players like Joseph Randall, who, now let's be real, Joseph Randall is not a saint. He's had some problems with the law, but it was not, they were nonviolent problems. He clearly has.
Didn't he steal some underwear?
He stole some underwear and some cologne. He was caught possessing marijuana, and the other week he felt really paranoid and freaked out and called the police to come to his house, and the police found nothing wrong when they got there. This is a guy having some real personal issues, but he can't average more than 4.1 yards behind a really great line, so the Dallas Cowboys cut him. Meanwhile, Greg Hardy will probably get a couple sacks this weekend, and I promise you, the announcers won't say much about anything that happened off the field, because all this league, and especially this team, does is enable this crap.
Well, should we be surprised? I mean, should we be offended? And you mentioned it, he's not the only scumbag. He might be the biggest one. I'm not even sure if he is. I'm sure there's stuff that goes on both in the NFL, all the major North American professional leagues that we don't know about, that's maybe far worse than what Greg Hardy has done. It's hard to imagine. But I mean, and then we'll still consume our NFL. We'll be happy as long as the games are exciting.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the case for a lot of entertainment products. You know, there's a lot of singers who aren't the nicest people. People are still listening to Chris Brown records. You know, this is not unique to sports, in which we're overlooking character flaws in our superstars. But I think where it is unique, at least in the Greg Hardy case, is that, yeah, there are probably other people in the NFL. In fact, there are definitely other people in the NFL who have done, you know, similar things. The difference is that when all the facts and the brutal pictures and the transcripts become known, and still absolutely nothing is done, that's when you cross the line from, you know, employing somebody of questionable character to standing behind somebody of obvious moral repugnance.
Yeah, and just not a nice guy either. Not nice to the media either. I mean, that was some ugly stuff, some of his post-game comments as well. Let's talk about what's going on the field with the Dallas Cowboys, Jordan, because they are 2-5. I don't think there's actually much debate as to who has the most talent when healthy in that division, the NFC East. It's clearly the Dallas Cowboys, is it not? But you lose one of the best receivers in the league for an extended period of time, and you lose a top five quarterback in the NFL for a real long stretch of time. It's near impossible to hang around. Now, that being said, they haven't won without Tony Romo. Are they still alive in that division race?
Yeah, probably. I mean, 9-7 is going to get it done in that division. So they got to go 7-2 the rest of the way, which is certainly not impossible. You got to win a game without Romo, because Romo probably won't be back till week 11, which means you got to win a football game with Matt Cassel as your starting quarterback. And that's a mountain to climb, to say the least.
Staying in the NFC, did we learn something about the Packers, or did we learn more about the Denver Broncos the way that went down last week?
I think you learned a heck of a lot about the Denver Broncos defense. That was the first really good offense they faced, you know. They beat the Vikings, who have a run-based offense, but certainly not a dynamic offense. You know, they beat the Raiders, who have a better offense than many people give them credit for. But other than that, the teams they beat have been some of the worst offenses in the NFL. You know, the Browns, teams like that. And, you know, I think you're on the verge of looking at this Broncos defense and starting to compare them to some of the great defenses of the past years, the 2000 Ravens, the 2002 Bucks, those kind of defenses. I'd like to see them do it for a couple more weeks, and certainly it'll be an interesting matchup this week. But, yeah, they're the class. To me, the Patriots and the Broncos are the class of the AFC. Even though the Bengals are unbeaten, I'd still put those teams a one notch ahead of them.
How is that defense, which is spectacular and one of the fastest in all of the NFL, if not the fastest, how much is that helping us paint the picture of what we think Peyton Manning is at this point in his career? Because, yes, the articles have been written time and time again about how he is done, how he can't throw downfield anymore. Meanwhile, his team is still 7-0, and yes, a large part of that is the defense, but at times he's been asked to do some things, and he's gotten it done at times.
He can still get it done. I mean, he's still one of the smartest football minds there is. He still knows how to break down a defense and find the open receiver and, you know, read the patterns, go through progressions better than almost anyone in the NFL. But the body's slowing down. And Peyton Manning and the Broncos are facing Andrew Luck and the Colts this Sunday. And it is a game between the two worst statistical quarterbacks in the NFL right now.
Like we all predicted.
Yeah, exactly. Luck and Manning are 1-2 in interceptions and 31-32 among starting quarterbacks in passer rating, which is astounding to me, but kind of fun.
Yeah, it is a little bit fun. Talking about poor quarterbacks, and I can't believe I'm comparing Andrew Luck and Peyton Manning to Johnny Football, but Johnny Manziel was back in the starter's role on Thursday against the Cincinnati Bengals, and his first career start came against the Cincinnati Bengals week 15 of last season, where he was absolutely atrocious. Wasn't quite as atrocious on Thursday. They still lost, but he had moments, I guess. Is your opinion changed at all on Johnny Manziel? Do you think he could ever be a valuable starter in the NFL, considering how thin the ranks are among quarterbacks in the NFL?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly possible. My opinion of him hasn't really changed since he came out of school. He's got a lot of talent. He's a very athletic kid. He's willing to take risks, certainly. He likes to look downfield when he's on the run, which makes for an entertaining, if not always well-quarterbacked, football game. And, you know, as much respect to Josh McCown, who has really been trying to sling it this year, and it has kept the Browns in some games they probably didn't deserve to be in. But Josh McCown's not going to be around by the time the Browns are any good. The Browns are 2-6 right now. McCown's getting injured every second week. I mean, what are you doing? What are you doing building for the future by starting an older career backup quarterback when you have a guy who, yes, is totally hit and miss and is probably going to miss some down the stretch, but could be something? I mean, it's like we talked about with the Leafs and their goaltending. Don't you want to find out what you have?
You would think you would, and certainly considering that that division is all but wrapped up with the undefeated Cincinnati Bengals, there's not a whole lot left to play for the Cleveland Browns. You wonder if they hand the reins off to Johnny Manziel, at least for the rest of the season, see what you got in him. Maybe he's got something. Maybe you can make a more educated decision on his future going forward. But a couple of good games coming up this week, week 9 in the NFL season. Packers and Panthers getting it underway. A couple of real good teams when it comes to the NFC. All right, that'll do it. Another edition of Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis, alongside Jordan Heath-Rawlings and Rory Boylan. This has been the Sportsnet Radio Network.